Coming up on Boston Public Radio, President Obama made his best case for a military strike against Syria last night. A retired colonel and Vietnam vet, Andrew Bacevich, makes his case that thinking we can bring order to Syria via military might is folly. Then we'll see if the president changed your mind with last night's 15-minute address. And speaking of Syria, Nancy Marshall Ginzer of Marketplace will join us to talk about what few others have. How much would a military strike cost?
The editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, on 9/11 coverage. How does he decide how much is too much? And also on Syria, he covered Bill Clinton during the Kosovo years. From WNYC in New York, Brian Lehrer on the wild and crazy New York mayor's race. Will Congressman Weiner ever return? And this is, of course, the 12th anniversary of 9/11. We once said nothing would ever be the same. Is that true? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
Last night, President Obama said he would pursue a diplomatic path on the Syria crisis, even while making the moral case for punishing the country for its deadly use of chemical weapons. And he described what he believed to be the implications for America.
What happened to those people, to those children, is not only a violation of international law, it's also a danger to our security.
He acknowledged he'd received no end of letters from people who were worn out by the protracted wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And obviously, he spoke on the eve of the 12th anniversary of 9/11, the event that irrevocably changed our foreign policy and military. Joining us for his take on what the president said last night and how to look at our military and foreign policy in a post-9/11 world is Andrew Bacevich. He's chair of international relations and a professor of international relations and history at BU, retired colonel, a Vietnam combat veteran, and a West Point graduate whose latest book is entitled Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Andrew Bacevich, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Hi, thank you for being here, too. So you just heard the president, I'm sure you heard him last night, Andrew, say that what's going on in Syria is a danger to us and to our national security. Do you think that that is true?
Well, I think the danger is a very modest one, and think, in fact, that the preoccupation with the Syrian crisis over the last several weeks really blows things out of proportion and distracts us from what I think is a much larger question that people in Washington or in the media want to ask.
What's the larger question?
I think the larger question is one that asks itself, when you step back and consider the range of military activities in the Middle East since Jimmy Carter promulgated the Carter Doctrine back in 1980, wars large and small, expeditions, airstrikes, and the like. And what we need to ask ourselves is, 30-plus years into this enterprise, how are we doing? Are we making the region more stable? Are we making the region more democratic? Are our military activities enhancing the standing of the United States in the eyes of the people who live there? I think the answers to those questions are no, no, and no. And therefore, to expect that opening up another front in this war by attacking Syria is highly unlikely to produce a different outcome. And so we ought to step back and ask ourselves if this our expectation that the deployment of American power is somehow going to fix things over there. Maybe that's just the bad assumption, and we ought to look for an entirely different approach.
Professor Bacevich, you know, I'm not an expert like you are, but I've read a lot about this, and I'm concerned the same thing, that we have not succeeded anywhere else. Why are we going to succeed here? And yet, as an average American, I'm sitting there last night listening to the president talking about American exceptionalism, talking about how if nobody else, no one's going to do this but us, and talking about chemical weapons and that the agreement in the world community that, ironically, making rules of war, but this is a step too far, and that if no one does anything about this, then we're just saying it's okay to use these chemical weapons. Maybe you call this cheap grace, Professor, but that appealed to my patriotism. What about that? That, you know, we just can't let this stand.
Well, I mean, there's an element of powerful truth in what you say. The problem, I think, is trying to parse when moral considerations or normative considerations do oblige us to act and when they don't. I mean, I'm struck by the fact that weeks before this chemical attack was launched in Syria, the Egyptian army brutally crushed protesters, Muslim Brotherhood protesters, and killed many hundreds of them. Now, they didn't kill them with chemical weapons. They killed them with so-called conventional weapons. But they were no less dead. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Egyptians who died because their limbs had been blown off didn't die just as miserable a death as those poor Syrian people. But there's no hue and cry that there's some kind of a moral compulsion or normative requirement for us to do anything in Egypt. So you have to ask yourself, why Syria? Why not Egypt? Why this case? Why not that case?
Well, Andrew Bacevich, let's stay away from Egypt just for a second and stay within the bounds of Syria. I assume you're then saying that you think it's an arbitrary distinction the president's making in Syria between the 100,000 allegedly, the rough number, I guess, killed by Assad or with conventional weapons and the 1,000-plus who've been killed with chemical weapons. He thinks, as Marjorie says, that falls outside that norm, the chemical weapons thing. You don't buy that.
No, I don't. I think you raise a good point. Okay, if indeed the killing of 100,000 is something that the Assad regime needs to be held accountable for, well, why not act on that basis? And then, quite frankly, it seems to me, if indeed moral considerations should be shaping our foreign policy, why is waging war the best way to acquit our moral responsibility? I'm always, a couple hundred cruise missiles attacking targets in and around Damascus do to benefit the people who have lost loved ones, who have been displaced, who are inhabiting squalid refugee camps? To some considerable degree, our inclination to use force in circumstances like this actually stems not from a reasoned calculation about what either would advance U.S. interests or would be the quote-unquote right thing to do. I think that we reach for our weapons and put our finger on the trigger because we really won't acknowledge the uncomfortable fact that the processes of change that are underway in the Middle East, with Syria just one example of those changes, really are beyond our ability to control. In some respects, American power is irrelevant. People in Washington have a very difficult time confronting that reality.
I want to focus on that for a second. You wrote a piece in The Globe the other day, an op-ed in which, and I'm paraphrasing, you said that the notion we can bring order to the Middle East is, quote, a vast illusion. So is your view that it's folly to think we can do anything to bring any level of order to any place in the Middle East through military means?
Yes, especially emphasizing the closing phrase there, through military means. My view would be that, broadly speaking, the people in that part of the world are going to determine their own futures. They're engaged in a quite violent and disorderly process of self-determination. I don't think we can control that or direct that. Now, on the margins, is it possible that we can nudge things in a certain direction to encourage the emergence of liberal values, for example, to encourage the development of democracy, to encourage genuine economic development that can improve the standard of living of these people? On the margins, I think perhaps we could make a positive contribution, but not through military means.
So that's what you say, when alternative ways to meet, as you said, our moral responsibilities. What are they? Where I think we're giving $1 billion in aid to the refugees, there are roughly 2 million of them. Should we be doing more? Should we be allowing more Syrian refugees into the U.S.?
That's roughly the same amount of money we give every year to the Egyptian military.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
So if indeed there is a moral obligation on the part of a very wealthy country, how is that met by $1 million a year in refugee aid? I mean, President Obama urged us to take a look at the videotape of the victims of the chemical attack, and we ought to look at that. But the other day, there was a news report I saw of the conditions in the the Syrian refugee camps in Lebanon. Well, let's look at that too. I mean, is there not some if there is an obligation to assist other people in need, what is our obligation to these Syrians who are living in these miserable conditions? I would argue it's not met by simply $1 million a year or whatever it is,
billion,
assistance to the UN.
We're talking with Professor Andrew Bacevich. He's a professor of international relations at Boston University and the author of the new book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers in Their Country. So let's get back to this chemical weapons thing. So, Professor, should we just kind of forget about this then and just say this is a ridiculous distinction and we can say it's terrible, but we should stop warring, not stop warring, but stop acting on chemical weapons being used on civilians wherever it happens to be?
Well, I'm repeating myself a little bit. And what I think we should do is to put Syria in a larger context, to in a larger historical context, in a larger strategic context, because I think that doing that actually enables us to have a better understanding of what is actually at risk, what is actually at stake. I'm not trying to minimize the use of chemical weapons. But, I mean, Jim just referred to the piece I had in the Globe a few days ago, which noted, not some sort of great revelation, that back in the 1980s, when the United States was supporting Saddam Hussein in his war of aggression
right,
against Iran, we facilitated his use of chemical weapons. And we didn't condemn Saddam Hussein at the time. We facilitated it. So this norm enforcement seems to be somewhat selective, to put it mildly. And I think that ought to be part of the conversation, because what it suggests is that perhaps our enforcement of norms is not really driven by moral concerns, but is actually driven by much narrower concerns.
What are those concerns? Because you've said we're not really doing this out of moral concerns or humanitarian concerns. So what is it then?
I think with regard to Syria, events are driven by two factors. And the first, never to be discounted in any sort of foreign policy crisis, is actually domestic politics. I mean, the president erred in drawing his red line when Assad called the president's bluff. The president discovered that his military options were unattractive, and the president obviously is not keen to go to war. All his military options were unattractive. Then, to make matters worse, the president found that basically nobody was supporting him, or at least very few people supporting him with regard to punishing Assad. And there, the key event may actually have been the British Parliament's refusal to endorse David Cameron's efforts to bring the Brits on board. So the president's out on a limb, doesn't want to be there by himself, and so he begins scrambling to try to find some cover, ergo, let's go to the Congress for the authorization to use military force. So much of this is about domestic politics. To the extent that it's about foreign policy, I think that this is an effort to try to disguise the extent to which our power is irrelevant. Make a pretense of slapping the Syrian government around so that we don't have to acknowledge that, in fact, the events in the region have a life of their own and are beyond the ability of the world's only superpower to direct.
We're talking to Andrew Bacevich from Boston University, and he's the author of a new book called Breach of Trust. I want to seize on what you talked about the public for a moment. It seems to me the one good thing that has emerged from this is the public appears engaged, and I know you don't talk about it. You lost a son in Iraq. We'll respect your decision not to talk about it. But what that highlights for people like me and Marjorie is virtually none of us have any skin in the game. And it seems we've been through Iraq and Afghanistan much of the time, except when there's a vote on appropriations, for example, in the Congress. We're sort of disengaged Americans who, to quote George Bush after 9/11, essentially go shopping. So it is a good thing. That's one good thing out of this, that America seems passionately engaged in this debate. No?
Well, I mean, if it's a passionate engagement, I'll agree with you. I mean, what you just you essentially summarized the theme of my new book, which is an effort to analyze the implications of the American people disengaging from their military and what that has meant in terms of the way the military gets used, and what that meant in terms of the success we have achieved or the lack thereof, and the costs entailed. And the book, in essence, calls for a re-engagement. If you're right that the debate over Syria begins the process of bringing the American people back into taking seriously where our soldiers get sent and what they're called upon to do, that would indeed be a very good thing.
Well, one thing that would guarantee involvement, I don't know how you feel about Charlie Rangel, the congressman from Harlem's annual call for a draft, not because he wants a draft, but I know you're a Vietnam veteran, but because if most Americans thought their sons or daughters were at potential risk, then we'd be engaged all the time. Is that something you embraced?
Well, I mean, the argument in the book is one that says draft probably not politically feasible, but maybe it's time for us to have a serious discussion of national service. National service means that every 18-year-old owes a term of service to country and community.
Amen.
I think that's a great idea.
Serving in the military, others serving elsewhere. I think that sort of program would close the gap between the military and society, could potentially lead us to exercise a certain amount of self-restraint in the way we use our military. And as a bonus, might enrich the reigning conception of citizenship by suggesting that citizens don't simply claim privileges and prerogatives, they actually have obligations.
We're talking to Andrew Bacevich from BU, author of the new book, Breach of Trust. You've also said, Professor, that being the strongest military power the world has ever seen, which we are and have been for some time, has not been good for the country. Why do you say that?
Well, I think, among other things, it creates illusions. I mean, we do have the strongest military in the world, and in some respects, it may be the strongest military that the world has ever seen. But let's go back and rerun the tape. The military doesn't win. I mean, we did not win in Iraq. We're not going to win in Afghanistan. Our lesser interventions in places like Libya, to take a recent case, have not produced positive outcomes. So we keep repeating this mantra about having the best and strongest military in the world, but we don't pay enough attention to actually the outcomes that are achieved. And repeating the mantra suggests that somehow this is an all-purpose instrument that ought to be employed. So we've fallen prey to illusions about what military power can actually do. And of course, who pays for the illusions at the end of the day? It's the American men and women who serve in uniform who pay for those illusions.
Andrew Bacevich, I don't know if you read a piece, several days ago in the Washington Post, written by the man, I think his name is Robert Scales, who's the former head of the U.S. Army War College.
I did.
And he makes the case, he describes General Martin Dempsey, who's the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sitting next to Secretaries Hagel and Kerry, and he describes the look and body language of General Dempsey, basically saying he wants no part of this. And he goes on to say that while he's not speaking for everybody in the military, he believes the Pentagon does not support the president in this, even though obviously they will do what they are told by the commander-in-chief. Do you buy Scales' argument?
He's a smart guy, and he's a well-connected guy, and I suspect that his op-ed was based on a pretty solid reporting. And it's not surprising, in a sense, that the military would be somewhat skeptical of intervening in Syria, in part because Afghanistan and Iraq didn't turn out well, and they may not be all that gung-ho about starting another war. One more point.
Sure.
On the other hand, to have a general, a retired general, Scales, publish a piece in the Washington Post that basically says, let me tell you the truth, all the active duty generals actually think that the president's stupid, is not conducive to reinforcing that principle of civilian control. So I think actually Scales was quite irresponsible as a retired general in, for all practical purposes, claiming to speak for the active duty military.
So, Andrew Bacevich, last thing for me, and this may be somewhat repetitive. You get 5 minutes today or 3 minutes today with the president of the United States. What do you tell him?
I say, Mr. President, Syria is not your problem. Your problem is that this nation has been committed over the past 30 years to an effort employing American military power to somehow fix the Middle East. It hasn't worked. It won't work. we need to go back and ask first-order questions and reformulate U.S. strategy toward that part of the world.
Andrew Bacevich, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew Bacevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University, and he's got a new book just out, reviewed in last Sunday's New York Times, actually, by Rachel Maddow from MSNBC. It is called Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. So, take...
I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You just heard us speaking to Andrew Bacevich, West Point grad, professor of international relations, a man who lost his son to combat in Iraq. He made his case against military action in Syria. What's your take after hearing from President Obama last night saying things like this?
On the right, I ask you to reconcile your commitment to America's military might with a failure to act when a cause is so plainly just. To my friends on the left, I ask you to reconcile your belief in freedom and dignity for all people with those images of children writhing in pain and going still on a cold hospital floor. For sometimes resolutions and statements of condemnation are simply not enough.
Change any minds last night? Did he change your mind? Did he make the case for a military strike if surrender of chemical weapons plan falls through? Do you hold any hope out for a non-military solution? Our number is 877-301-8970. You know what a lot of people said? When we were all talking to guests, to friends, to people in the newsroom, what's the president going to say last night? The conventional wisdom was he's not going to say anything dramatically different from what he said all along. The difference is the president is saying it, staring into a screen, and people were right. That's exactly what happened. There was nothing extraordinarily new or different. And the question is, does hearing it from the president's own mouth, particularly the repeated references, Marjorie, to the chemical weapons and their effect, their deadly effect on children, in Syria, did that sway any people's minds? The question you asked Bacevich a couple of minutes ago.
Well, see, he's terribly convincing, Andrew Bacevich is, and he's written brilliantly about this whole dilemma, and he's very mad at the press for our coverage of these war issues as well in his new book. But I guess I come down to the thing I said to him before. I don't buy – the president did not convince me that this is in our actual – that we are – in any danger from Syria at all. He didn't convince me of that. But he did – it gnaws at me, I guess, the idea that if we don't do anything about this, nothing's going to happen. And I've said this before. It's the idea that chemical weaponry is different and that we did have this international agreement on the non-use of chemical weapons. And he pointed out that Ronald Reagan didn't do anything about the chemical weapons that Saddam Hussein used against Iran, and we know that. But still – To do nothing sort of bothers me.
Well, Bacevich, in his defense, is not arguing we do nothing. He's talking about, I guess, what that guy over at the Kennedy School calls soft power, do humanitarian aid, do other things.
But what
not
does that
this.
Actually mean, though? What does that actually mean? Does that mean to go over?
He said more humanitarian aid.
Does that mean
accepting more refugees into the United States? He said yes to that, too. So he's got a plan. By the way, if you didn't hear the president's speech, which is hard to believe, the excerpt that Marjorie's talking about, where he talks about the fact that why acting after chemical weapons attacks makes us exceptional is this.
America's not the world's policeman. Terrible things happen across the globe, and it is beyond our means to right every wrong. But when, with modest effort and risk, we can stop children from being gassed to death and thereby make our own children safer over the long run, I believe we should act. That's what makes America different. That's what makes us exceptional.
877-301-8970. The polls that were out as of yesterday morning, CBS New York Times said by slightly more than a 2-to-1 margin, the American people opposed military strikes. Did the president change anybody's mind? Who was in that category? And if you were a yes prior to last night, Did he make you feel even more strongly
just
that
before
way?
We get to the cause, due respect, I don't think taking in more refugees to the United States solves anything. The Syrians don't want to come to the United States. They want to stay in Syria. So that's kind of the issue. I guess it would be a nice short-term thing, but I don't think that's clear. And I don't think Basevich is clear on what exactly we do to solve those humanitarian concerns.
Well,
anyway.
I mean, let me be fair here. If he was not clear, it's because we didn't ask him the question repeatedly enough to let him be clear. We just didn't focus on it. He just said there are other things to do, and he's not alone. A lot of people feel, as he said, he did answer the question quite clearly when I mentioned I think we're giving $1 billion in refugee aid. He says that's the same amount of money we're giving to Egypt, and look what's happening there. So 877-301-8970. And I know a lot of people, by the way, who think even if we do nothing more on the humanitarian front, even though those videos are as powerful gets, that a military strike is a very risk-laden, troubling proposition that the president didn't make the sale. Let's go to Art on the Highway. You are first on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey there, Art.
Hi, Jim and Margaret. I've called in before, and I wish I had more time. But basically, this professor is examining his navel, and we have to see this thing for what it is. Unless everybody, I mean the public, the politicians have been not telling us the real fact. The fact is that we are in a world situation. We have three regions in the world that have nuclear capability: Israel in the Middle East, India and Pakistan, and North Korea. We don't want them to use those weapons. We don't want them to use any weapons of mass destruction. Imagine this discussion going on if Pakistan was using these chemical weapons next to India. It wouldn't take much to tip the balance.
Well, wait a second. Art, just let me be clear. First of all, North Korea is going to be dealt with by Dennis Rodman, so we don't have to worry about that. But Art, on a serious note for a second. Let me just be clear here. I don't think that there's anything that Andrew Basevich said that would suggest if we thought that a nuclear weapon was about to be used by Iran or anybody else, that we should sit tight and hope for the best. I think one of the distinctions he's making, I have to say, I find this very powerful. I understand the history of chemical weapons, for example, that Marjorie has talked about, that the president has talked about. I can't shake the notion that we do nothing for the slaughter of 100,000 people. And by the way, if another 100,000 are slaughtered by conventional weapons, I assume we'll do nothing about that also. But the chemical weapon killing of 1,000 is the basis for us getting involved in another entanglement I don't find to be terribly compelling. But Art, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. Let's, by the way, since Andrew Basevich is not here to defend or his positions, let's talk about what the president said last night and what your reaction is to what the president said. You know, he listed five areas where he got questions. And he went down the list of things that people had had concerns about, all of which were legit. The one he didn't answer, of course he's not going to answer, is the one we've broached many times in the show and other people. I think Susan Collins from Maine has broached, is we do a military strike after these negotiations fail, if they do, over the surrender of weapons. Saddam Hussein uses chemical weapons again. What do we do then? I mean, that's a pretty important question that liberals and conservatives are asking on Capitol Hill, and I think they deserve an answer. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Maeve from Watertown. Hi, Maeve.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Maeve from Watertown, and I want to first say that I absolutely think that you people, I know I'm supposed to talk about the president, but you people are wonderful to have the programming that you have all consistently.
You have
thank you.
That you can have time for, Maeve, but thank you very much.
I just wanted to say that I don't think that people are aware that those, when they talk about missiles, and I think Andrew Basevich is brilliant, absolutely, all the points that he said, but the idea that those missiles that they talk about, we are creating $1 million missiles. Each one is $1 million. And I don't think people realize how it's taken away from our lives here in the United States.
Maeve, you know, you should be working on the show because in about 20 minutes
we're
or 15 minutes, we're going to talk to a woman from Marketplace on NPR.
Exactly that.
Who's going to talk about the actual cost, which has not been enough part of this debate. Maeve, thank you so much for the call. By the way, Rand Paul did a little video last night. I think it was about 6 minutes long. Kentucky senator. Here's what he had to say, rebutting what the president of the United States had to say.
Americans, by a large majority, want nothing to do with the Syrian civil war. We fail to see a national security interest in a war between a leader who gasses his own citizens and Islamic rebels who are killing Christians. Some argue that American credibility is on the line, that because President Obama drew a red line with chemical weapons, America must act or lose credibility. I would argue that America's credibility does not reside in one man.
He essentially became the de facto spokesperson last night. Not, I don't think he was formally anointed by the Republican Party, but he became the de facto spokesperson for the other side on the news.
You know, we just got an email from Carl, and our email address is bpr@wgbh.org, correct?
It's not .org. I think it is, yes.
And he's talking, part of it says that we need to have a discussion what it means, America's place in the world in 2013, because that's a lot of this issue, too. Are we going to be the ones? I mean, I thought yesterday we were talking with Chuck Todd from NBC and MSNBC and about being the policeman of the world. And he said, well, would you prefer that somebody else is the policeman of the world? And I thought, oh, my goodness, who would I prefer? Would I
no, prefer? But that's the wrong question. With all due respect to Chuck Todd, if you read that CBS New York Times poll yesterday, I mentioned this to him, what Americans were saying in the 70 percentile range was, go to the UN, work in coalition with other countries. That's not the way we've historically seen the world, but it apparently is the way we see the world in 2013.
But obviously, the UN is not an option here, and we're not going to get anywhere. We're not going to. I mean, maybe the Russians are going to pull this off, and maybe we're going to have this great save at the last minute. But they certainly haven't been an option up to now.
By the way, if they are not an option, there's a military strike, according to the president. While Russia is saying they will not vote for a resolution that includes any military action,
the point is, we have basically gone alone in most of these endeavors. I mean, it was back when the first President Bush was going into Iraq that we had some sort of coalition. Mm-hmm. Then we called it the coalition of the willing or the unwilling, or was that later on? But in any case, it's us. It's us that goes into these places. And I think that's part of what this whole debate is about. Do we want to give up that situation of it being essentially us, or do we not? And no one is really talking about that bigger issue.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Malden, where Sam is on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you
wonderful
for making
program.
It. Thanks.
I am so sick and tired of hearing the president wave the flag. It's you know, after 10 or 12 years, it's just so tiring, and it's just not believable. I'm looking for an adult conversation about foreign relations. Foreign relations are not based on emotions or how sorry we feel for some kids who got gassed. Of course it's terrible, but these things happen every day. And you know what? The United States is to blame for a lot of it. We have to step back and take a good, honest look at ourselves and answer the question, why do they hate us so much? You know, we are not the ones with clean hands, and we're not exceptional here.
Well, you know, that's the second.
You were exceptional.
Sam, I was totally with you until the last sentence. Why do they hate us so much is maybe an important topic for discussion. But the issue in Syria is at least about our involvement. It's not about whether or not the Syrian rebels or Assad can stand us. The question is, should we get involved in a civil war? And as you say, should the video is unbelievably compelling, you can't watch it and not practically cry, should that be the basis for us going into a region, a piece of the Middle East again?
And never has been, never will be. Foreign relations are not based on feelings. They're based on interests. And I think what adults want to hear from the president is, what are our interests in Syria? I'm not saying that human suffering is not a good reason to get involved, but it's never been a reason in the past.
Well, we didn't play the sound, but what the president said last night to make the case that if they have chemical weapons and we do nothing, then chemical weapons can get in the hands of other terrorists, and then ultimately, to continue down the line, ultimately they can be a threat to us and our people. You're saying you don't buy it, and at least as of before his speech, neither was most of America.
Neither does the rest of the world. It's so hypocritical. We're the ones who use nuclear weapons. We're the ones who used phosphorus weapons in Iraq. We're the ones who use cruise missiles.
Yeah, but Sam, I'm not convinced
Sam,
that the rest of the
thing is, we have used human suffering as reasons to get involved before. We did it in Kosovo. Bill Clinton said his biggest regret was not doing it in Rwanda. So I think we have used it. We've used it in humanitarian ways as well, which maybe make you more happy. But the other thing I think you have to remember that Basevich said is that, in his perspective, the United States case is irrelevant, just irrelevant in the Middle East. We've not succeeded anywhere we've gone in, and what we think or what we do is, in his book, is irrelevant.
But Sam, let me also, I agree with what Marjorie said, and let me just add one note about your conclusion that nobody else in the world shares our view on this. It's very possible that many countries share our view, but based on what Marjorie said a little while ago, they know we don't have to worry about sacrificing our people or crippling our budget because the United States is going to do it. And so I'm not sure one can conclude, whether it's from the parliament vote in the UK or anywhere else, that it's not because they don't buy the cause. Maybe they don't, but because they know they don't have to participate. Sam, thanks for the call. 877-301-8970. You know, it's sort of the point that I meant to make to Basevich before. I am driven nuts, and you and I have discussed this for years, about how unengaged the average American is in any of these discussions about either putting other kids, families, sons and daughters and husbands and wives at risk. That's the only healthy part of this. The vast majority of the American people, for whatever reason, whether it's because of Colin Powell a decade plus ago, whatever it is, the vast majority of the American people are engaged in this thing, which is, I think, terrific.
I think, despite what the caller last said, part of that is because people have been devastated, even though they don't may not know anybody personally in their family that's been in the military, by these endless stories. You know, we went through the Boston Marathon disaster and tragedy. What happened? Soldiers who lost their legs were coming up to Boston in droves to show the people that suffered in the marathon that their life could go on, that they could be better.
How powerful was that, by the way? Those stories.
It was hugely powerful. And you interview people. I mean, you've interviewed them. I've interviewed them. Soldiers who come back and they've lost eyes and they've lost arms and they have traumatic brain injuries and they're not able to get over these things and they're shooting their wives because they've lost their minds over in Iraq. So part of that, and that's, I guess, emotion, is why the American people have said, this is crazy. What are we doing this for? Iraq was a mess when we went in. Iraq is a mess now.
So what happens in a handful of – John Kerry's going to meet with the Russian foreign minister, I believe, tomorrow. The president said he's going to continue conversations with Putin. What happens, getting back to your point, when it's clear that Russia will veto any resolution in the United Nations that ends with the words, military action shall be taken if Assad is not in full compliance? My assumption is the United States wants that day to be as far away as possible, even though John Kerry said there's not going to be a lot of time here to comply. What happens at that point? Do you think after last night, the president of the United States, after this he didn't call it a cooling off period, I will, after this cooling off period where he's trying negotiations, if it fails, do you think there's any increase in either the American or Congress's support for a strike? I don't think so.
Well, you wonder what he's going to do, too. I mean, he's desperately looking for a way out of this, obviously. What does he do? If there is no way out of it, does he go ahead and do a strike?
Well, that's what he says he wants. He wants the authority to strike if Assad does not comply with what he said he's willing to comply with.
Alex in South Dartmouth. What do you think, Alex?
Oh, come on, Alex. I just want to sort of attack this whole credibility angle here that the president was really just seeking to cover himself in terms of U.S. credibility. I disagree. Obama's message last night did not sound to me like a president that's seeking our help in maintaining U.S. credibility. It was a president who clearly and confidently describes the moral responsibility of what it means to be leader of the free world. So I don't know.
Alex, I'm not cutting you off. I just want to be clear. So you support his message, and did you support the message prior to hearing him at 9 o'clock last night, or was that what did it?
Sealed the deal in many respects, but in my heart of hearts, I had faith that our president had a strategic plan here, and I believe, and I don't buy the argument that Obama now is on the receiving end of a windfall bestowed on him by Sergey Lavrov in this situation.
There's a great piece, Alex, we're losing you, it's a bad connection, thank you for the call, it's a great piece in the Globe by Matt Visor talking about, was it a gaffe? Or was it a long-term discussion that was going on that led to that comment by John Kerry, which led to these discussions, which may cause the military strike to be averted?
But I'm arguing against myself now because, of course, one of the great things that Basevich said was, well, if we are so concerned and the leader of the free world is so concerned about this terrible moral outrage, How does lobbing missiles over these same people make that moral outrage any less outrageous?
Well, I can answer that question on behalf of the president. What he would say is, I believe that if we send a very powerful message. What was the great line last night? Mm-hmm. Some people are saying a pinprick won't work. The United States military does not do pinpricks. It was a pretty great line. I think his answer would be, if our military might is powerful enough, it's going to send a message. You better not do this stuff again. So he would argue that is going to help the citizenry of Syria.
And then arguing against myself once
again. Do it again.
Well,
you're doing brilliantly at it, too.
It's very, very possible that were there not this threat of an imminent military strike that Putin wouldn't have done
that's what he says. That's his argument.
Well, I mean, I think that that's a plausible argument, too. You know what? No. I'm glad I'm not the leader of the free world. Can you imagine having to make these decisions? No wonder the guy's hair has gone so gray.
Yeah, it's so amazing. I don't know if I even said this to you. I don't think I ever had that thought until about a week ago at the beginning of this thing. And I was saying, I don't know what was it. We're hearing, you know, Obamacare is going to be defunded for the 42nd time by the House or 41st time.
No, I hope not.
The sequester, are they going to shut down government? Is immigration reform Syria, whatever, Egypt is exploding? And I said to myself, can you imagine waking up every day?
No.
We're concerned about doing a radio show. You do a column. I do a TV show. It's not exactly heavy lifting. It is surreal, really. That anybody has the capacity to go to bed every night knowing what they've got to face the next day.
And that they can sleep when they do go to bed. Nick from West Bridgewater, what do you think, Nick?
Hi, I just think that there was a really great point that I don't think is being emphasized enough in the president's speech, which is that chemical weapons are indiscriminate, which kind of makes it different from a gun battle between rebels and an oppressive government.
Marjorie's been saying that for days, by the way. Maybe not as eloquently as the president, but you're right.
Certainly
it's a really
not.
Important point, Nick.
Right. So I think that should have been emphasized a lot more. And if I was the president, I would be very disappointed by the international response, especially by like British Parliament not supporting us and things like that, because I think that the American people might have more confidence if there was a more responsibility on the international community, not just that it felt like it was American.
I don't think you should use the word may. I don't think there is any question. I'm not suggesting the polls would totally turn around, but a huge part of the reason, in my estimation, that the American people are overwhelmingly opposed to this military strike, even if it comes after a negotiation period, is because, as Marjorie said, they think we're doing it alone. Nick, thanks for the call. You know, the best example, we've mentioned this before, of whether you love him or hate him or like his policy or don't, of his coolness under pressure. We've mentioned this repeatedly. On the night that he had authorized the assault on the compound where he hoped Osama bin Laden was, Barack Obama was with the White House Correspondents' Dinner, not only with, and I think it was the guy from Seth Meyers from Saturday Night Live.
Yes, telling all these jokes.
Making jokes about getting Osama bin Laden. And you see the camera go on Obama with his beautiful smile. He does have a beautiful smile.
He's got nice teeth.
He's laughing. He's going along.
I think he flosses.
At the same time, he knows that the most critical decision in his years as president was just made hours earlier. So
yes,
there's certain people cut out for this.
And then you know that later on that evening, they're all in that Situation Room with that incredible picture. Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, everybody watching the television of that great scene we all saw when we went to see Zero Dark 30.
Let's take one more. Charlie, you're in Providence, Rhode Island. You're going to finish this up on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think that that the only reason that America wants to go in there in the first place, it's all about the corporate interests, and they have their own interests, and it has nothing to do with the kids getting gassed or anything like that, and we don't even know who gassed them.
Well, I think the president thinks he knows who gassed him. Who's corporate interest, Charlie?
Well, I think with all the corporate, I mean, you've got a lot of defense contractors who want to get over there. You want to get a lot of businesses over there. Eventually, you want to have Syria as like kind of like another puppet regime where people just go in there and...
It's worked out great for us in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Charlie.
Let me just say, even fierce critics of the president's decision-making here... Very few of them are suggesting, one, that there was not a gassing, and two, that Assad was not behind the gassing.
He's got the weapons.
Yeah, but he hasn't admitted that he did the gassing. But I think there's a very small minority that are questioning, and hopefully this is not going to be a repeat of weapons of mass destruction of a little more than a decade ago. Thanks, Charlie, for your call. Thank you all for your phone calls.
Okay, when we get back, we're going to get a dispatch from Washington, D.C., and how Congress is juggling the money involved in Syria and, of course, the budget. And, of course, Obamacare. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
12 candidates are running for mayor of Boston. Who are they and what are their plans for the city? I'm Emily Rooney. All this week we meet the Boston mayoral candidates, three candidates over four nights. We'll get their take on the city's most pressing issues. Join us for a special Greater Boston tonight on WGBH2 and right here on 89.7 WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Welch & Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch & Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marguerite. And we've obviously been talking about how the White House is handling Syria. Capitol Hill has been debating the morality, the strategy, the risk. But is anyone asking, can we even afford to go into the region to begin with? Joining us to go over how Congress is handling that issue, plus the rest of its full agenda, is Nancy Marshall Genzer. She's a senior reporter for Marketplace based in D.C. Nancy, great to have you on.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
So, Nancy, if we do go in this limited way, what are we talking about money-wise?
Yeah. Who knows is the short answer. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel was asked that last week at the House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing, and he just sort of waved away the question and said, oh, tens of millions of dollars. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, was asked by a Senate committee to come up with a cost estimate, and it basically threw up its hands and said, we don't know because the president hasn't said exactly what he would do. There are some estimates that it could be $300 million to $1 billion. But one thing is clear, the Defense Department has plenty of money to pay for it. It has something called the Overseas Contingency Fund. I wish I had one of those, which has an estimated $86 to $90 billion in it. So even if a strike cost $1 billion, they've got at least $86 billion to play with.
You know, the reading I've been doing, well, we've all read the stories about how apparently one of these missiles that could be launched is somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million, $1.2 million. Even if they're not launched, I read the other day that just the presence of one of these battleships off Syria, something like $25 million a week. So whatever the actual number is, we all remember Dick Cheney said we're going to be in and out of Iraq and, you know, in a nanosecond and $2 or $3 trillion later. How much of the debate has been focused on this, or is the fear that if people talk too much about money in Congress, they're going to be seen as heartless heathens?
You know, they're not talking much about it publicly. And you are right. The estimated cost of keeping these huge Navy ships within range of Syria, $25 million per week. Each Tomahawk missile costs $1.4 million. If the U.S. actually fires missiles from these ships, the cost of keeping them near Syria rises to $30 million a week. But yeah, I mean, nobody's talking about that publicly.
Nancy, you're not a Bostonian, but I'm sure you've heard of the Big Dig.
I have. I drove past it.
Well,
when it was under construction,
we drive through it all the time. And if you're I'm not a native. Marjorie is a native. I've only lived here 30 years, so it doesn't count. But if you follow the history, and most people apply this formula, I guess, to virtually everything that government does that's a major project, it was estimated to cost $1.5 billion, and the final cost is somewhere in the neighborhood of $16 billion. So at a time, it is amazing to me that this is not center stage and a time when everything is about where the money's going to come from. Do we have to shut down government at the end of the month unless Obamacare is defunded? We have these sequester cuts. I have to say, I am really surprised it's been so absent from the debate.
Yeah, you know, it is really surprising. And I can only surmise that they don't really want to nitpick, as you said, you know, at a time when we're asking the military to do something extra. They don't want to nitpick over the cost.
We're talking with Nancy Marshall Genzer, senior reporter for Marketplace. You know, Nancy, for those of us who don't understand the way the federal budget works, and I'm one of them, you just mentioned this what was it, $86 billion overseas contingency fund or something they've got for these...
Contingency operations fund, yeah.
Yeah, that they got for these expeditions. So when they're debating the budget this year, is that just out there someplace different in the military budget, or where is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just out there.
It's just out there.
Not part of the regular appropriation for the Defense Department.
But that's what it's called.
A contingent overseas operations contingency fund. Wouldn't you love to have a contingency fund?
So if there's an unexpected situation, we have that money, those billions and billions of dollars available for that expedition.
Right. And, you know, if you think about it, obviously, if we were attacked in some way, you wouldn't want to have to go through Congress to get money to pay for defending ourselves against an attack. So it does make sense. But that's why Defense Secretary Hagel isn't sort of holding his hat out for money for this. He knows he's got it.
Well, but also, we should keep in mind, $86 billion, it's what was the great line by by Dirksen, former senator from Illinois, ultimately a billion here, a billion there, eventually you're talking real money. $86 billion, if we get into this further than the president is talking about, is basically pocket change.
Although the idea that it's there makes it easier to get the day or two started. You know you got the money already there. I just think psychologically, if you're making these decisions, you don't have to wait. You can just go.
Hey, Nancy.
Exactly.
One of the things that I have not heard much of, except maybe from Senators McCain and Graham, obviously from South Carolina, a partner of McCain's in much of this stuff, is there were sequester cuts made in the military, and a lot of the hawks were of Democratic and Republican variety, were upset about them. Are they making the case that what we do in Syria is a good argument to undo a lot of the cuts to the military that were ordered as part of this mess that they couldn't get themselves out of?
Yeah, I think some of the defense hawks might make that case. But remember, the Republican Party is really split between those defense hawks who want more money for the Pentagon versus the Tea Party types who want to cut every department of government, even the Pentagon. So that's not necessarily sort of a universal chorus.
Speaking about the Tea Party, rest of Republican split, we're obviously hearing a lot less of this now, Nancy, because of the focus on Syria. There were, 20 days away from a potential government shutdown. The issue was, are some of the Republicans going to make the case, unless there's a defunding of Obamacare, we're not going to refund government and we're willing to let it shut down. That's been reduced from the fevered pitch it once was at. Where is that now? Is that off the table, essentially?
Well, Republican leaders thought that they had come up with a compromise where there would be sort of two parts to a bill to keep the government running. And the first part would make the Senate vote on whether to defund Obamacare. The Republicans wanted the Senate to have to go on record. But they could then, vote on that and then put it aside and get to the issue of whether to fund the government with what's called a continuing resolution, which just keeps things funded at the level they're at right now under sequestration. The right wing of the Republican Party really doesn't like that idea, and they want to actually hold the government budget hostage to completely defunding Obamacare delaying it for a year.
Nobody is even contemplating another Gingrich Clinton standoff from the 90s in 2013 in the middle of the Syria debate, are they?
Well, that's why the Republican leadership came up with that first proposal, that two-parter, where they sort of decouple Obamacare from the budget, even though the Senate would have to vote on it. But a big faction of the party does not like that idea. So the Republican leadership may be faced with the choice of whether it wants to risk being blamed for a government shutdown.
You know, every time people talk about defunding Obamacare, there are millions of Americans who've got kids between 21 and 26 who are covered under their parents' insurance, so they don't have to go out and buy insurance of the kids without health care and their jobs. And there are people with pre-existing conditions and stuff like that. Should they be worried, Nancy, or is it just never going to happen and everyone can relax?
Should they be worried
that, that they're about to lose the insurance for their kids or those parts of Obamacare that most people are very enthusiastic about because they help them, the pre-existing condition when you change insurance companies or change jobs or the insurance coverage that's now available for kids between 21 and – well, young adults, I should say, between 21 and 26.
Young adults, yes. You know, as far as that particular provision goes, the provision allowing parents to insure their kids up to age 26, a lot of insurance companies just did that on their own, regardless of Obamacare. So I think parents can rest assured that their insurance companies are not going to abandon that. But as far as the pre-existing condition clauses and those other aspects, yeah, they could go away.
Well, they could go away if Barack Obama took a vacation. The reality is, even if the House, what would it be, the 41st time they vote to repeal Obamacare, even if that vote were to carry in the House, either Harry Reid would stop it in the Senate, or even if Harry Reid couldn't stop it in the Senate, the reality is Barack Obama, after which the health care bill is named, is going to veto the thing. So all this endless conversation, at least until Barack Obama's a former president, yeah, is just spinning wheels,
well, that's what
right?
That's what you keep telling me, Jimmy, and I hope you're right, but Nancy's making me a little bit more nervous here.
Well, you know, that's the conventional wisdom right now is that, you know, no way would this pass the House and Obama would never sign it.
No, I didn't say it wouldn't pass the House. I'm saying it would pass the House and it has.
I mean, the Senate.
Would never pass the Senate, right?
I meant the Senate. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Obama might be forced to compromise and say, agree to suspend, for example, the requirement that individuals get insurance for a year. Or maybe suspend the pre-existing condition requirement for a year. So he may have to compromise.
Well, that's a great question that I hadn't even thought about. One of the issues that I assume is going to come up in the fall is something you touched on a minute ago, Nancy, and I'll end with this, is when the president decided unilaterally to suspend the provision for a year requiring that employers cover their workers over a certain, you know, in businesses of a certain size, people who are not terribly fond of Obamacare said, wait a second, that's not terribly fair. If you're going to give the businesses another year to comply, why shouldn't individuals have another year to comply? The administration and its supporters said that's apples and oranges. Is that likely to happen, that the individual mandate provision on this thing could also end up having a year hiatus a la the business provision?
You know, I really don't see how it could happen because so much of Obamacare is predicated on everybody being required to get insurance. So you have a bigger pool of people who are insured to kind of support the folks who are the sickest. You know, the folks who are the healthiest really need to jump into that pool to support the others.
Nancy, thank you very much for reassuring me, I think. I think
we'll
see. That's what it's always about with Marjorie and Nancy.
And Nancy Marshall-Genzer is a senior reporter for Marketplace based in Washington, D.C. You can follow her on Twitter at Marshall Genzer. That's Marshall with two L's, G-E-N-Z-E-R. Okay, when we come back, it's time for our weekly open mic with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
If you're thinking of starting up a tech company, forget about that market analysis. If you just begin with one of these two questions, you'll be on the right path.
Wouldn't it be neat if? That would be one very good starting point. Or, isn't it odd that?
I'm Kara Miller. We get other tips and the inside track from Silicon Valley luminary Guy Kawasaki this week on Innovation Hub, Thursday night at 9 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Mass Mocha, presenting Fresh Grass, a three-day festival of bluegrass and roots music, September 20th through the 22nd, featuring 25 bands, including Infamous String Dusters, Noam Pikelny, Sam Bush, and more. Freshgrass.com. And Sullivan Tire and Auto Service, family-owned and operated with over 60 locations across New England. From oil changes to computer diagnostics, their technicians are prepared to maintain your vehicle. Locations at SullivanTire.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. It is open mic. It is Wednesday. He joins us every Wednesday on open mic. He is the editor of the Boston Globe, and he is Brian McGrory. Hello there, Brian.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie Egan. How are you?
Very good, Brian. Nice to talk to you again. You know, this is the anniversary of 9/11, 12 years out. And this is sort of behind-the-scenes question. I wonder, you get the front page of the Globe today. You've got President Obama at the top of the fold. At the bottom of the fold, you have a tease for a story about a young man lost his dad in 9/11, was running in the marathon this year when the bombs went off. How do you decide where to place on 9/11, how much coverage you give to it? I mean, I'm wondering, if the president hadn't spoken last night, would 9/11 still be above the fold in the Boston Globe, or is it 12 years away and we don't do that anymore?
I mean, it's an interesting question, and we actually struggled with it a little bit over here yesterday. We were thinking of going with a teaser photo above the fold for 9/11, given the significant impact it had on this community. There was all sorts of news, Syria, the president's speech. And we decided that a photo below the fold and a story on the Metro front would seemed appropriate for what was going on that day. If you'll remember, a couple years ago on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we had a 7 or 8 part series.
Yeah, you did a lot of it.
That marked it. And it was a lot of work by a lot of people, and I think it turned out really well. And, as the years go by, we certainly don't want anybody to forget it, not that they ever would, but I also don't know that it should necessarily trump the news of the day either.
Well, you know, it's sort of a weird thing. I mean, we're gearing up now for the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK, and there's going to be all this hoopla and stuff at the JFK Museum and new books coming out and stuff like that. It is sort of weird how we in the news business, I guess it's the zeros, you know, that every 10 years, every 20 years, every 50 years is when we really zero in big time, which is, I suppose, on one hand, it seems silly. On the other hand, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be completely honest with you, Marjorie. I'm not a huge fan of anniversary stories unless they have some impact on what's going on today. I think we should mark them. I think we should. There are things that are worth commemorating, certainly. But I'm not, newspapers are supposed to look forward as much as they do backward. And that's kind of how I prefer to see it.
You know, lucky for you, Brian, I'm the only person in America who's reading your old columns. And one of the things I did...
I didn't know, Jim. There are two. You and me. You and me.
I actually, on a serious note, I shouldn't be laughing. I looked at that 8-part series that the Globe did exactly 2 years ago. Your piece, Up From the Ashes, which was a long piece, the part you wrote, it is so... And you almost feel guilty. We're going to talk to callers about this at the end of the hour. But you almost feel guilty not, whether you're a newspaper editor or a human being or something in between, about not focusing as heavily just because it's not the 10th anniversary. But all I want to say is people should go back and read this stuff. On the 10th anniversary, when everybody was focused, the work everywhere, particularly at the Globe, was really powerful. But, what I want to talk to you about, Brian, is I think it's a mini obsession of yours. It's a maxi obsession of mine. This is also the 2-year anniversary of something else, the triple murder in Waltham. We haven't talked about this in about a month. I continue to be stunned that we know almost nothing about how one of the alleged murderers of these three men in Waltham, Ibrahim Todashev, what happened with him and the FBI agent and the two state police and the Orlando cop. I am amazed that the FBI, theoretically, unless I missed something, took DNA from Tamerlan Tsarnaev to see if it matched the DNA on any of the bodies or in the room in Waltham. We know nothing. We know nothing. Are you frustrated by this?
Oh, God, I'm completely frustrated by this. It's absolutely stunning how little we know of what happened in that apartment in Orlando or outside of Orlando this summer. It's truly, or late spring, it's truly, truly maddening that this far out we don't know how he died, why he died, what led to his death, and what he did or did not know, or what his involvement was or wasn't in that heinous triple murder in Waltham. It's incredible when you think about it. Believe me, we're still looking at it hard over here.
I'm sure.
But the lack of information that's been forthcoming is extraordinary.
Well, you know what is going to be a fascinating sidebar to all this is if Martha Coakley does throw her hat into the ring for governor. We had Juliette Kayyem, your former columnist, who is running for the Democratic nomination. But if Coakley was criticized her first time out when she was running against Scott Brown for not being aggressive enough on certain kinds of investigations. She has refused to investigate what the state troopers from Massachusetts were doing down there in Orlando. And I think this, if she does run, I think this could hurt her because it plays into that same narrative.
Well, there are two troopers in the apartment. We've
exactly.
got conflicting information over the months about whether they were in the room or not in the room when the shooting occurred. But, yeah, there's no question. There were two Massachusetts state troopers in that apartment, and they were there investigating this triple murder in Waltham. And that makes it all the more frustrating about what's going on. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, this could be an issue in a gubernatorial campaign. Maybe, maybe not. I'm not quite sure of that, but there's certainly the potential for it.
Okay, so Matt Visor writes a story on the front page of the Globe today, debating the analyzing the debate. Was it a gaffe by John Kerry that led to this potential breakthrough that could avert a military strike? Was it something that's been discussed on and on? You've read all the stuff. Where do you fall on this, Brian McGraw? You know John Kerry for a long time.
I think it was all of the above. I think it was, look, at what's a gaffe in this day and age? I mean, it's pretty awful in politics in 2013 when you can make the most, I was going to say minor misstatement, but I guess talking about Syria is not a minor misstatement, but everything is exacerbated, everything is put under a microscope and then blasted through a megaphone.
Megaphones, yes.
And it can be really frustrating. In Kerry's case, I think it was probably something north of a gaffe, something south of a mistake. I think it was probably on his mind because he knew that Obama had been talking about it with Putin, and he went and just kind of spouted off about it and then quickly said, you know, not like it's ever going to happen or anything like that. And it ends up, it's this bizarre moment in the history of American diplomacy where it might actually resolve this significant problem over there.
We had Chuck Todd on yesterday, the White House correspondent for NBC, and I know you did that in your former life. We want to talk to you about that, not for NBC, but for the Globe.
I can remember being on your show before, and all you would do is talk about what Chuck Todd just did. But go ahead.
I love the numbers, man. He was a great numbers man.
You know what he did yesterday? Was it in The New Yorker this was? He says there's a fictional debate between Biden and John Kerry. Who made the better gaffe?
Yeah.
Did Biden do the better gaffe, which forced Barack Obama to embrace gay marriage, or did John Kerry do the better gaffe, which opened up this avenue of potential breakthrough? But I know Marjorie wants to talk to you about your White House days.
Well, before we get to the White House days, you know, when you were a columnist, I know you were a frequent diner at some of the great steakhouses in Boston. Did you ever go to the Capitol Grill or Grill 23 with John Kerry, Brian McGroy, when you were a columnist?
You know what I had? Where's this question going, first of all?
Well, I guess I'm sort of...
You're supposed to say, please answer it, and then I'll tell you where it's going.
Yeah, I'm sort of stunned by his performance this week. Not, I don't mean
in
to say
in a good way or a bad way?
Well, his passion, and I just... He's been extremely passionate about Syria, and it sort of surprised me, which is why I asked if... You know, he didn't strike me when I've had conversations with him as that passionate of a guy, except back in the Vietnam days. So in your time at the Capitol Grill, what do you think about him?
I might disagree with you a little bit on this, Marjorie. I think he is fairly passionate about these issues, and he does have his Matt Visor in the Globe, chronicled over the last few weeks. He's got some pretty deep history over there in terms of dining with Assad and really following this very closely and wanting to have an impact on this bizarre civil war that they're having over there. I think that he is extremely invested in this, and it's really been fairly extraordinary to see how out front he has been on this issue.
You were a White House correspondent when, I believe, for the Globe, at the time that Bill Clinton was saber-rattling about Iraq. Were you there during Kosovo days or no?
No, that was before me.
So let's talk then the Iraq and Clinton. How different is life as a White House correspondent? How different is the president? How different is the whole world when you're in Washington when war is being contemplated?
Well, keep in mind there were periods back then that Clinton was dropping bombs. If you remember, after the Monica Lewinsky story broke and Clinton was on the Vineyard, he launched attacks. I'm trying to think of where they were. Were they in Sudan and one other nation? And it was a bombing mission, the kind of thing that now would be something fairly extraordinary that seemed oddly ordinary at that time. Do you recall this?
I recall it. I don't recall where, and I don't recall the details at all.
It was the wag the dog theory. Everybody's wondering if this was ridiculous.
Exactly.
If it was some
to divert
kind of
attention away
from
Lewinsky, right?
Exactly.
And you know, look at it. It is different during times of contemplation like this when we are contemplating going to battle, or in this case, bombing runs. You know, I compare this one, because of the shuttle diplomacy that's going on, more towards more like what Jim Baker did ahead of the first Iraq war, mm-hmm. When we were very active in terms of seeing what kind of alliance we could form, what could be headed off, what could we do to blow Iraq out of Kuwait without actually having to fight them out of Kuwait. There seems to be a lot more diplomacy involved here, especially when Obama decided to go to the Hill and get their approval before he did launch attacks.
Can we go from overseas back to Massachusetts in a front page story you have in today's paper?
If people don't recall this, they should recall, but they may not because so much happens. The Globe did a series about the probation department, the hiring practices in the probation department. They resulted in federal racketeering charges for the guy that used to run the probation department, a guy named O'Brien. Ryan, you've got a front-page story by Andrea Estes, formerly the Herald, now with the Globe. She's a great reporter.
She hasn't been at the Herald in like 20 years.
Okay, it's not 20 years.
Sakes,
it's not 20 years.
Claiming credit here.
Maybe 12 years. It's been a while, but she is a great reporter. She's
a great reporter
for us, and she's a great reporter for you.
She's terrific.
She is terrific. Anyway, she's got a great front-page story, which is kind of discouraging, Brian, because it leads me to wonder if the scandals and the bad hiring practices are continuing. Tell people what your front-page story, in essence, is about today.
Well, it's unbelievable. This guy, Joseph Ligotti, is a clerk down in Hingham District Court. And, I mean, he's had his fair share of run-ins with his reputation, with ethical issues over the years. And he used to be represented by what he says is a friend of his, Bob Juvenville, who's a former state police detective. He's now on the Governor's Council. And he's gotten representation for him. They have been publicly friends, and lo and behold, Ligotti needs a new assistant clerk, does a proverbial national search, 200 people apply, some of whom have actual law degrees, which may help considering they're working in a court, and Ligotti goes and hires a woman by the name of Maura Juvenville, who is the daughter of his good friend and lawyer, Bob Juvenville. And so we, you know, set out to write about this. And what's more disturbing is that Harry Spence, who is overseeing these kinds of hires and trying to, you know, his job is to make sure they're all on the up and up ever since we broke that probation department story. He is trying to block this hire, but an association of state court clerks is saying, no, this is fine, which is driving people crazy. I mean, this isn't fine.
But getting back to Marjorie's question, is the moral of the story that lessons have not been learned, or is this an outlier? By the way, in the spirit of full disclosure, we should say Marjorie and I used to work with this Ligotti's son,
yes.
And actually Joe Ligotti the Jr. is a friend of mine who was mentioned just briefly in the story. But is the moral of this story that they, whoever they are, learn nothing from the probation scandal?
Well, look, I think the state learned quite a bit from the probation scandal. I think there have been mechanisms that have put in place to stop this kind of blatant patronage hiring and turning the probation department basically into a criminal enterprise in terms of, or certainly an untoward enterprise in terms of campaign contributions in exchange for jobs. And it's not what you know, it's who you know. So people like Harry Spence, who has been put in place to oversee all this, he is evidence that lessons have been learned, and we do believe that things at probation have gotten better. Are they perfect? No. And are we all always going to have brush fires like this? Yes. And hopefully when we do have them, the Globe or Harry Spence or somebody will be there to point it out.
Yeah, but you know what? When I read a story like this, and it is a great story, Andrea Estes used to work at the Herald. And
that's
works
right,
at
she
the Globe.
Did.
When I read a story like this, or when Suzanne Bump, the auditor, comes out with some audit that is just appalling, not the audit, but the what she uncovers, you say to yourself, I don't know who, I'm guessing, I know you can't respond to this, I'm guessing Harry Spence was disgusted and then contacted Andrea or somebody at the Globe. But if things like that don't happen, or dimes aren't dropped like they ultimately were on, for example, McLaughlin at the Chelsea Housing Authority, where essentially he had fixed it so that all his board members who knew what was going on were part of the deal so they'd never spill anything, I worry that there are a multitude of these kinds of things going on, and we just have no idea until somebody drops a dime. That's not an unfair conclusion,
Jim,
right?
Come on, you simplify it to the point where it's quasi-insulting to what people do over here. We don't sit around drinking grape high C waiting for somebody to call us on the phone and say, here's what you're not going to believe.
Mm-hmm.
We have really experienced, well-trained, aggressive investigative reporters throughout this building who are very channeled into various agencies and communities all across the state. So it's not a matter of just waiting to hear. It's a matter of going out and finding this stuff, yeah, which we do, certainly with the Spotlight team, definitely with people like Andrea Estes. And for every time we break a story on something like the Ligotti case or the McLaughlin case, my bet is that there are 100 other politicians or government officials or business people who see what happened in the Globe. They take stock of what happened, and they're very hesitant to get into the same kind of thing.
Okay, I'm chasing.
Yeah, I guess the one thing that is just depressing to me about this story is, as you know, Brian, because it was in your paper, that the group that represents the court clerks is challenging Harry Spence. And so that's a little...
It's demoralizing.
It's totally demoralizing, because just knowing a lot of people that have worked in the court system and knowing how difficult it was, the people that work in the probation system as well, that really were, you know, got passed over for it, their whole careers, frankly, is just demoralizing that the court clerks could be this obtuse about this.
Well,
hiring.
Not to mention the quality of service that's provided by people who
probation.
Are unqualified
it's
to do their
very
jobs.
It's a big deal, yeah.
By the way,
probation was a critical department.
Critical.
That never got to do what it was intended to do because it was overrun by patronage.
Yes, and they were demoralized because you would see people that were really talented, devoted their lives to probation and really believed in the cause, passed over, like I said, for a whole career. So anyway, that's
by the way, Sudan and Afghanistan was where the strikes were in August of 1998. Thanks to our producers for that. Hey, Brian, before you go, we haven't talked to you.
Thanks to Brian. Brian said Sudan.
Oh, you did. Well, half thanks.
Jim, Marjorie, yeah. Do you ever get the sense Jim's not listening to you when you're on the air with him? Do you
listening
ever get that sense?
Listening to me? He never listens to me. He tells me to talk faster so he can get in what he has
to
say.
That's the old me. That's not the new me, Brian.
When Jim is not talking, he's bored to tears.
Have you noticed that, Brian?
I have noticed that. So inappropriate.
Whenever I am talking, that's why I mispronounce everything so often, because whenever I'm talking, Jim motions to me from across the room.
Hurry up, Marjorie.
Get
in light
out there.
Of that comment, I'm going to allow you to speak in response to this as long as you want, Brian McGorry, editor of the Globe. A serious question. Where's the what's the status of the completion of the sale to John Henry of the Globe?
It's going well. It's due to close, I believe. Everybody is targeting sometime in October. People are working hard toward it. John Henry is very engaged as he's looking at the operation. He's excited. We're excited. And it's all on a good path right now.
How many people have asked you for World Series tickets? Truth. No, I don't mean that as a joke. I mean it as a serious question. Can you talk to the guy for me?
If you think that I have access to World Series tickets, you're out of your mind. Can we just say one serious thing, though?
Certainly.
Not on the sale. Back to the 9/11 issue.
Sure, yes. Please do.
I mean, that 10th anniversary story, the series that we did and the story that I got to do, it really did hit home for many, many people 10 years later, just how long the impact is from 9/11 and the loss of life and what it means to pick up and try to carry on in the wake of this absence, even a decade later and now 12 years later. The day still haunts, and it will always haunt.
Well, you know, one of the things, and I'm sure you've heard because you've interviewed many victims' families, and so have I over the years, one of the things that many people will say to you is that you have a terrible tragedy in your family, and then you take time, and time can make things not go away, but at least feel better. What did you see this morning? You saw the airplanes hitting the World Trade Towers again, and you hear it's all over the news. So every year, that death of your loved one, the wound is reopened again, and it makes their tragedy unique, I think.
Completely reopened. And we had an extraordinary series of Twitter files from tweets from a reporter of ours, David Filipov, whose father, Al Filipov, died. Mm-hmm. And the first plane to hit the first tower, and he did something that's on bostonglobe.com now that's and bostonglobe.com that's quite compelling to read.
Brian, good to talk to you. Brian McGorry, thanks so much for your time.
Jim, Marjorie, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Talk to you next week.
Bye now. Thank you very much. Brian McGroy joins us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Brian McGroy is, of course, the editor of the Boston Globe. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, please tune in to hear Christopher Lydon with us on our Thursday open mic. Okay, we've been talking about the Boston mayoral race. Emily Rooney, by the way, every night this week at 7 o'clock, doing great debates with the different candidates, a kind of a discussion debate kind of deal. Up next, we're going to talk to the guy who's been tracking the New York mayoral primary, a man no one ever heard of until a couple of days ago was the clear winner of that primary, Bill de Blasio. He'll run against Republican, the Republican in that race. And who are these guys? How did they win? WNYC's radio host Brian Lehr joins us for that conversation next, 89.7 WGBH.
This week on Greater Boston, meet the candidates running for mayor of Boston. I'm Emily Rooney. Hear three candidates a night over four nights as they discuss pressing issues facing the city. Join us for these unique discussions with the candidates for mayor. Tonight at 7 on Greater Boston on WGBH2 and right here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick or at doverrug.com. And Stana Stairlifts, whose stairway chair lifts can make it easier and safer to get up and down stairs. You can learn more at stairliftboston.com or by calling 1-800-UPSTAIR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. When Anthony Weiner was leading the race on the Democratic side for the New York mayor, we checked in with Brian Lehr. Then, in a matter of weeks after that, an unearthed sexting scandal and a campaign ad featuring a biracial family changed everything. Joining us to explain how the outcome became the outcome in New York City to everybody's, at least our great surprise, is Brian Lehr. He's the host of the Brian Lehr Show on WNYC. Hey, Brian.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Brian. I just want to make sure I am right about this because de Blasio was very close to the 40% that would enable him to be the candidate against the Republican. He made it, did he not? Or is he still facing a runoff?
Well, not yet. And this is actually the big drama here right now. The tally as of the end of last night was that he had 40 and 15/100%.
I love that.
But that's without all those paper ballots counted. You know, people who had trouble at the polls, absentee ballots, military ballots, and that's like 20,000 to 30,000 votes, which is way more than the margin that he's got over 40%. And the speech last night that the second place candidate, Bill Thompson, gave was an every vote must count speech. So we're waiting for him to come out and see if in the light of day he still thinks, since he was 15 points behind, that it's worth his money, worth his time, worth the disunity in the Democratic Party to challenge it and count every vote. But look, in the post-Bush versus Gore era, there are a lot of Democrats who just want to make sure that every vote is counted every time. So this is not over, this Democratic primary.
How long are we talking about for this, well, not recount, but full count to happen, Brian?
Well, they're saying Monday at the earliest, and then 2 weeks or so after that would be the actual runoff election, if it turns out to be required.
I think they better make sure they don't let Bloomberg near the ballots, if you know what I mean. How is Bloomberg dealing with the fact that the guy he trashed said had a racist message? He, obviously, the incumbent mayor. How is he dealing with the fact that it appears at least likely that that same guy is about to succeed him?
He's dealing with it by endorsing his opponent. Bloomberg told New York Magazine last week that if Loda is the nominee, de Blasio is the nominee, that he would endorse the Republican nominee, who is Joe Loda, who used to work for Mayor Giuliani and ran the MTA, the transit system.
Well, let's be optimistic on de Blasio's part here. If he does, what happened? He was, as we said before, he kind of came out of nowhere. He wasn't supposed to win. Lots of people thought this Christine Quinn woman was supposed to win. She went down in flames. How did he pull this off?
Christine Quinn, who is the Speaker of the City Council, was running on a platform of things are in pretty good shape, after 12 years of Bloomberg. Our city is better off economically than a lot of other places in the nation. We need to make some changes, but more or less stay the course. And it was a pretty optimistic message, really, but that's not where the Democratic Party electorate was. Most of the Democratic Party electorate was sick of Bloomberg. 75% in the exit polls yesterday said we need a change from Bloomberg policies. And so she was seen as too close to Bloomberg. And de Blasio, who ran openly tagging himself as the most liberal candidate in the race, you can't do that in a national general election.
No.
In a New York City Democratic primary, you even can't always do it then. But it was the right message for the right time this year. And then that TV commercial that you may even heard of in Boston that featured his son, who's biracial because his wife is black, gave him credibility in the black community that he hadn't had before, because people just didn't know that he was actually from a biracial family until this ad started like a month ago. And then all the ducks lined up.
Well, speaking of that ad, I think everybody up here has heard it. But if you haven't, here's the ad featuring his multiracial family. This is de Blasio. Afterwards, you'll hear a brief piece of his speech last night in Brooklyn. Here it is.
Bill de Blasio will be a mayor for every New Yorker, no matter where they live or what they look like. And I'd say that even if he weren't my dad.
To the people of New York City, I say thank you. To the people of my beloved home borough of Brooklyn, I say thank you.
So are the rumors true that Anthony Weiner already has a Sabrett's hot dog truck lined up on the corner of 64th and Broadway? What's this guy got? He came in dead last, right?
Yeah, but let me give you a figure that's going to blow your mind.
Yeah.
He came in dead last out of the five major Democrats. He got more votes than the Republican nominee. That shows how tiny the number of registered Republicans in New York City is. Anthony Weiner got 29,000 votes, which was fifth. I should say 31,000 votes, which was fifth. Joe Lota, who's the Republican nominee, won with 29,000 votes. That's in a city of 8 million. And so that's how much of an uphill climb he theoretically has, although New York hasn't elected a Democratic mayor since 1989. We've had Giuliani and Bloomberg after that. So that's, you know, just an interesting tidbit. But Anthony Weiner, on the way out the door, literally gave the finger to a reporter last night. So he wound up with one coda of a Twitter moment. I'm sure you can find it.
Now, Huma, his wife, did not show up apparently last night for his concession speech. What are we to make of this? That she's finally come to her senses or what?
I guess. I don't know. You know, it's family stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, you pick your spots, but she has a serious career. They knew it was a moment where he was obviously going to be giving a concession speech. I guess it was just a sort of modest thing to do.
You know, by the way, if you can't, we're probably not going to talk about him again until he does something else of note or non-note. Here is Weiner calling himself an imperfect messenger in his concession speech last night. Here it is.
When I would travel around, when sometimes things got a little dicey on the campaign, and I'd go to a subway stop or I'd go to a concert or a church service, sometimes people would come up to me and they'd wrap their arms around me or they'd pull me close to whisper in my ear. They'd take my hand. And they'd say, don't quit.
Well, the people quit for him. Well, in all seriousness, what's the word on the street, Brian Lehrer, about what Anthony Weiner does next?
I don't think there is a word on the street about that yet. I think people are not even speculating about his life and throwing up his, you know, their hands and ready to be done for a while anyway with Anthony Weiner. And, you know, maybe forever as a candidate for elected office. I don't even hear people talking about it, to be perfectly honest. You know, for Weiner, he told me and told a lot of people that he was surprised at the reaction to the new revelation. So he was in first place the last time you and I talked in the middle of the summer, as you mentioned. And what is it that came out after that? It was the fact that he didn't stop sexting until a year after he had resigned from Congress for sexting. But he said it was still a true statement that he was no longer doing it once he entered the mayoral race, and he didn't expect people to be so concerned with exactly when he stopped as opposed to that he stopped. So that's just his, you know, his take on it. And obviously people were very concerned with when he stopped and what that reflected about his character and, by implication, his honesty.
We're talking to Brian Lehrer, the host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, about the New York mayor's race. There was another race that kind of surprised me. I thought Eliot Spitzer, who was running for controller, might have done better than he did because, you know, he had his transgression, as everybody knows. He was involved with a call girl and client number nine. Everyone was joking about how he wore his black socks when he was having his trysts with this woman. But he is a numbers guy. He was tough on Wall Street. I thought he would do better than he did.
Well, it was a very close race. He just lost by a few points. And one factor is that the entire political establishment, from left to right, lined up behind his opponent because Eliot Spitzer is a troublemaker. You know, he's going to fight the interest. And if he was coming into this race without even the support of the Democratic Party interests, which, of course, he had when he was governor, then everybody was against him. So there was Wall Street money that lined up against him. There were public sector unions who were more afraid of him than they were of Scott Stringer, who lined up against him. There's the Working Families Party, which is the sort of party to the left of the Democratic Party that has some clout in New York City. They lined up against him. So it was this very bizarre combination of everyone from sort of Goldman Sachs executives to the Working Families Party. But these are groups that organize turnout. And I think that was a big factor, that, you know, instead of organizing against each other, as usually happens in the New York election, all these groups were organizing for each other with one goal in mind, which was to stop Eliot Spitzer, and he couldn't quite climb over that mountain.
We're talking to Brian Lehrer from The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. We're going to change gears. Obviously, this is not just the day after the primary elections and the mayor's race in New York City and controller's race and other. It's obviously the 12th anniversary of 9/11. We know you were there at WNYC 12 years ago, Brian. Here's a clip that I'm sure is familiar to you. It's a sample of what happened on your airwaves at WNYC on 9/11 and the immediate aftermath.
This is WNYC 93.9 FM, AM 820, and online at WNYC.org. There has been an explosion at the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. The upper floors of the Northern Tower at the World Trade Center has experienced an explosion.
The building is falling right now. People are running through the street. Smoke is everywhere.
These buildings are a fixture of the New York skyline. You're used to seeing them there. To look over the top of the building and not see the two twin towers is just something that, as a New Yorker, it's like a piece of your life has vanished.
2 hours prior, the biggest news story of the year was Chandra Levy. But here now was disaster layered on disaster, multiplied by the prospect of war.
There is so much to talk about, and we'll take a lot of phone calls today just to allow us to reconnect. I really want to know, how are you? How are you coping with this? When I've heard callers, I've heard a real need to talk.
The last voice, of course, is yours, Brian Lehrer. What's it like to hear that 12 years after the fact, Brian?
It was giving me some chills, I have to say. I don't think I've heard that since the day. And it's obviously a day that things always kind of go at a different pace and people are at a different emotional plane in New York, as I'm sure will happen for years and years and years to come on the day of the Boston Marathon after this year. And so even as, you know, hyped up as everything is with the politics here today and as hyped up as everything is with the Syria debate, I think every single New Yorker is taking a few moments of quiet reflection, even if they weren't personally affected on 9/11. And, of course, for those who were, things are never the same in their lives.
Well, yeah, explain what that means. I lived in New York City for 15 years, but prior to 9/11. Mm-hmm. How, other than on the anniversary date itself, how has life changed in New York City? How are things different?
Well, that's a big question. Remarkably little in most ways, I think, is one important answer to that question. We were remembering this morning how when Michael Bloomberg was running for office in 2001, which was in the weeks immediately after the attack, that he was running on a very optimistic platform and tone of voice. And one of our political reporters was recalling to me that there were people around him advising him not to do that, that he should have run on a hunkering down kind of message. But one of the successes of the Bloomberg era has been that he was able to help us, and I think New York has the spirit in general, but he tapped into it, go forward and not look back and not live a fearful life. Life is incredibly normal in most of New York most of the time. Then there are things like the police department's espionage, if that's the right word, on mosques, which is extremely controversial, but has to do with trying to figure out where the potential terrorist cells are, but where do you cross the line between preventive investigation and monitoring people on the basis of their religion, which is unconstitutional or at least offensive. And so that's one way in which things have changed.
Brian, how's the Freedom Tower doing? I've seen it a couple of times in the midst of construction when I've gone down there. It's pretty tall.
I think it's great. I think it's awesome. It's beautiful. They'll see if they can populate it and, you know, whether people have some hesitation about moving in there with their companies and into the area in general, because if it was a target twice, why won't it be a target a third time for some radical or some crazy? And yet, what they're building down there is fabulous, and I know that New Yorkers think it's just great that we didn't, quote-unquote, let the terrorists win, to use a cliche, and kind of abandon that real estate.
Hey, Brian Lehrer, as always, it's a pleasure. I'm just thinking, as we say goodbye to you, last time we talked to you, Anthony Weiner was going to be the mayor. Today, de Blasio is going to be the mayor. We'll call you in a month, and it's going to be that Republican with 29,000 votes, right?
It'll be the dog from the top of Mitt Romney's car.
Seamus, if you're looking for the name, Brian. Brian, okay. Thanks for the time.
Bye, guys.
Thank you very much, Brian. Brian is the host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. You can catch him online at wnyc.org/shows/BL, of course, for Brian Lehrer. Okay, Brian, again, thank you. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you guys what you think. It is the anniversary of 9/11. It's 12 years later. We're opening up the lines for a catch-all of 9/11. How did it affect you? How has it changed our country? How has it changed the way we live, you live? Have we learned anything, particularly as we contemplate invading Syria? From our response to 9/11, we are at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970.
Researchers at UMass Medical School in Worcester announced they'd found a way to shut down the extra chromosome that causes the developmental problems of people with Down syndrome.
Higher education impacts everything from our economy to our ability to remain a world leader.
We were fortunate to get funding for high-risk, high-impact work.
Listen for reports from WGBH's Higher Education Desk on campus with reporter Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Celebrity Series of Boston, celebrating its 75th season of presenting great artists in classical music, jazz, dance, spoken word, and more. Tickets to more than 70 performances are on sale now. More at celebrityseries.org. And WGBX 44, though often misunderstood by their peers, these two detectives solve their nation's most confounding crimes. Watch Sherlock Holmes at 8 and Death in Paradise at 9, Wednesday on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here's Ken Feinberg. He was the overseer of the 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund, and as you know, the Fund for Boston Marathon Bombing Victims as well. He talked about how important it was for him personally to meet with the victims of the 9/11 attacks.
People came to see me. They didn't really want to talk about money. They came to vent about the curveball that had been thrown them. Mr. Feinberg, thank you for seeing me. I was married to my wife for 25 years. She died at the World Trade Center. I'm here because I want you to know what an angel she was, and I'd like to now play a video of our marriage 25 years ago. Well, Mr. Jones, you can play that. I'll be glad to listen. But, you know, that'll have no bearing on the compensation. I want you to see what those murderers did to my angel. Play the video.
So it has been 12 years since 9/11, since the trade towers fell down, since the Pentagon was struck, since a plane went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. So what's changed since then? Did you or somebody you love or know end up in the military, deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, both? Did the way you live change, from airline travel to your civil liberties, flight attendants, immigration lawyers, priests, rabbis, imams? How would you characterize, for you, life after 9/11? It's 877-301-8970. What? How about for you?
Well, I wouldn't want to live in the Freedom Tower. I'll tell you that. I'd be very nervous.
No, I have to say,
if my company was going to locate in the Freedom Tower.
As you said,
Tower,
it's a very tall building.
It's
in
a
lower
very,
Manhattan.
Very tall building. It's got this huge, what do you call those things that stick up above?
Spire.
Spire. And it's beautiful, but it would make me very, very nervous. I think travel has changed completely. I mean, we're now in these ridiculous lines at the airport taking off our belts and our shoes and going through all these metal detectors, mm-hmm. and taking pictures that they say are not being flashed around the world, basically pictures of you that are naked pictures of you. That's really bizarre. But I think, you know, it's like time changes everything. I mean, right after 9/11, remember people were debating, you know, the Red Sox games, the Yankees games. The Yankees were playing the Mets. Is there going to be another terrorist attack in the middle of a baseball game? Or when you go to Gillette Stadium, are you going to be a nervous wreck going to Gillette Stadium? I don't think much about that anymore. Do you?
No, I don't. And you mentioned the most obvious manifestation to me is plane travel. I don't fly as much as I used to, so it might be going to a sporting event where there are going to be 20,000 or 60,000 people. And some of the ways it's changed are ways we only think about when there's a news story, things like the NSA discussion that we had of late. And obviously that debate would probably not have happened, nor would the surveillance have happened had 9/11 not happened. But I think for most people, and obviously I accept those who were related to either as friends or loved ones, the 3,000 plus people whose lives were extinguished on 9/11, it seems to me that, well, no one is ever going to forget. You know, that's fairly obvious and doesn't even need repeating. I don't know why I said it. Except for those families, people have moved on. I think we've even begun. I mean, you mentioned, I don't think we're going to have to take our shoes off much longer at the airport. I think they're getting rid of that thing, which was aggravating to everybody after the shoe bomber. That was not just 9/11. It was 9/11 leading to the shoe bomber, leading to the shoe thing. But I think it's starting to swing back in the opposite direction. The response to the NSA stuff. My guess is if that NSA surveillance had come to light 5 years ago, people would have said that same tired expression we hear all the time. I'm willing to give up a little bit of my personal liberty for security. You didn't hear that much anymore. So I guess where I'm going is 12 years after the fact, while things may have changed on the government front, I think the vast majority of people, and I could be wrong, we'll hear from callers at 877-301-8970. For the vast majority of people who weren't directly affected, they'll never forget, but life pretty much has returned to normal.
Well, I think one of the things that's been very detrimental, I mean, on the one hand, there has been no other 9/11, so you want to credit the government for what they've done in terms of their investigatory powers to prevent that sort of thing happening. But I worry that we are spending billions and billions and billions of dollars on NSA-type projects and all these places mm-hmm. out there in the middle of nowhere, to these big buildings to compile all this data, that
Utah,
we have this big
I think, yeah.
spying network. And again, that's taking money away from other things, you know, from the airports. It used to be pretty nice in the United States of America. A lot of them look pretty dumpy now and those kinds of things. We're not spending the money in the right places. And I also, I mean, I remember thinking this after the marathon here. We used to have this expression, after 9/11, we can't let the terrorists win.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't stop flying. You can't stop going to the airport. You know, I remember thinking the day that we had the shutdown in Boston, and it's been very controversial. We were looking for the younger Tsarnaev brother who was later found in Watertown. I thought, in a way, I know many people would disagree with me, but I thought shutting down the whole city, I thought that was going backwards. It was kind of a letting the terrorists win kind of thing, that all of Boston came to a close to look for a 19-year-old kid that was in Watertown. So
Well, that whole notion of we can't let the terrorists win, in part, it underlies the reason we were in Iraq, Afghanistan, and to a degree why we may end up in Syria. So there, I guess what I'm saying, in the big picture, things have changed quite a bit. In terms of people's everyday life, unless they were directly affected, I think at least, not only have people's lives returned to normal, but I think people's sensibilities about things like surveillance, about security, about inconvenience based upon what happened 12 years ago, I think people have the pendulum is swinging back. 877-301-8970. I was also glad you asked Brian McGorry. We'll get to your calls in a second, by the way. I was glad you asked Brian McGorry that question about what kind of angst, you didn't use that word, what kind of decision-making was there internally about what you do to honor 9/11 after the fact. 12, it's not the 10th anniversary. It's not a major anniversary, again, right, unless you're directly affected. But don't you feel guilty? When we were planning the show, for example, one of the discussions we had was what Brian had with the Globe. How much attention do we give to the anniversary of 9/11? And ultimately, we decided we would talk to a few of our guests about it and obviously speak to Andrew Bacevich about the president's speech, a little bit about 9/11. And now it's your turn. 877-301-8970. But, you know, it is amazing. It was 12 years ago. I mean, is it amazing, the images, the first time you see them on the television in the morning, if you're not in
New York City?
They're
all over the place this morning. All over the place this morning. And as I said before, that's hard for people who lost family and friends to see those images again and again. Every year you see the images.
But they're not, I have to say, I watched a little bit of television this morning. They're not doing it with the same relentlessness, which I thought was grossly excessive and exploitative, that's been done in prior years. Can you agree to that? I mean, they're doing it, which is responsible. It is what happened. It's history. It's important history in this country. But it's not this loop, essentially, that we're being treated to around the clock. 877-301-8970. Where are you 12 years after the fact? How has life changed for you? Has it begun the change back? Let's go to Patricia in a car. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hello there.
Hi. How are you?
We're
nice
very good.
To you. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Yes, I lived in Battery Park City, which was directly across the street from the World Trade Center, and I lived there for 25 years. And I was there that day and watched the towers come down. I watched something that I still can't get out of my eyes, which were people jumping and their suits were flapping. I thought it looked like black feathers falling from the sky. I remember getting out of the neighborhood and seeing everybody covered with ash and just the horror in everybody's faces. And we lost four dear friends on that day, two firemen and a couple who was working at Cantor Fitzgerald. I will never forget it. I hope that this country never forgets it, because our innocence was truly lost that day. And in as much as New York City is a city of strength and courage, that day in itself really shook it to its core. I don't think anybody who was there and experienced it will ever be the same, because any time there is an attack, such as the Boston Marathon, it brought me to my knees. I'll never feel safe ever after seeing what devastation can happen.
You know, Patricia, you said that incredibly beautifully, but before you go away, when you say you hope this country never forgets, what does that mean? How do you hope the country never forgets what happened 12 years ago? What does that mean?
Well, I do agree with what you said earlier, that it shouldn't be pushed down our throats every anniversary, that perhaps, you know, there is, and I hate to use this term, overkill, but just never to forget the 3,000... so people lost their lives. Families' lives were ruined. And there are young people who don't even understand what it is. And I think it should just never be forgotten. I'm not sure exactly how to put that.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. One of my first thoughts this morning after I saw the video was exactly what you just mentioned. How about the high school junior who's 16 years old, who was alive for this, but was not really compos mentis?
Yeah,
he or she was 4 years old, 5 years old. Right. What did they say now?
I
what did
know.
They say 2 years ago? But Patricia, that was an extraordinarily good call. Thank you so much for your time.
We know it was a great point Patricia made, to the loss of innocence, because, of course, we had not been attacked
on our shores. Right?
We had Pearl Harbor, but, of course, that was over in Hawaii.
Right.
It wasn't on the states between California and Massachusetts. So it made us equal in an awful way with much of the rest of the world, not a way you want to be equal with the rest of the world. Liz from Western Massachusetts. Hi, Liz. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
Good. I called in because I think it had kind of a heartstring effect on me. I grew up in New York. My high school prom was actually at Windows on the World.
Windows of the World, for those that don't know, was the restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center. But go ahead,
Liz. And I still have my prom glasses, my champagne glasses from there. I found that living far away, and not so far, what, 3-hour drive away, I was so removed from what had happened, and I was so connected. And what this event of 9/11 did to me is it made me want to go back to New York. It made me want to be there because I couldn't stand being away.
Why is that? I mean, why is that? Is it the same sort of thing that motivates apparently tens of thousands of people to want to run in the Boston Marathon next April? Is there something else?
Maybe. It's just like it's a connection that I felt was lost or is lost by me not being there. And it's a connection to New York, to my home. And
yeah.
I want it back. I want that connection back. And so horrible as it was real and it was there. And the good and the bad and the, you know, the amazing is there. And I want to go back.
Liz, another beautiful call. Liz, thank you for the call. You know, the planes, obviously we know where the planes came from.
Logan
Airport.
And one from D.C.
I believe.
The plane that went into the field in Pennsylvania.
Right. But I lost my train of thought. But it's a different kind
of
thing.
From New York?
The reality is if you're in New York City or you're near the Pentagon – obviously it was a field in Pennsylvania. It's a totally different kind of thing, unless, again, your family was one of the people who happened to be on that plane, or in the case of one of the planes, obviously the pilot was a guy from Massachusetts as well.
Barbara from Nahant, we're talking about 9/11. What do you think, Barbara?
Well, I think that the world got a lot smaller that day. It seems like I don't know anybody who didn't have somebody impacted. So, you know, friends or family or coworkers. Mm-hmm. I had coworkers on planes to L.A. that had left just later that day, so they weren't injured. But mm-hmm. everybody I knows somebody who died. It's amazing.
So how much, other than on the anniversary itself, obviously today is number 12, how much is this a part of your life? Is it in the back of the brain as opposed to the front of the brain? Where is it the other 364 days of the year, Barbara?
Well, for the first few years, I actually did commemorate it with friends in a sort of public way, but now it's just back of the mind, and it does come up when something like the marathon bombings mm-hmm. happen, or, you know, I have friends who have come from other parts of the world and now live here, and they say, you know, this kind of thing happened, you know, the marathon bombing happens in Beirut, you know, every week, or... You know, it just feels like we're more connected in some way.
Yeah, that was the point Marjorie made a minute ago. It's in a horrible way to gain a connection, but I think your point and Marjorie's point is well made. Barbara, thank you so much for the call. We have time for another couple. It's 877-301-8970. Chris, you're in Warwick, Rhode Island. You're on with Jim and Marjorie.
Hi. Thanks. I enjoyed listening to your show very much.
Thank you.
I was 16 when the towers came down. And now, fast forward in 12 years, you know, when it happened, it felt like it was in my face everywhere. You know, when you go to the airport, of course, with the Transportation Security Agency and all the things that happen in government. But as time has passed, it seemed almost as if the government response has remained, but that feeling, that danger and really immediate presence of that event has faded. But what's left is, you know, now we have the NSA and this whole thing. But that's almost what remains, and that initial painful shock has, to me, faded quite a lot.
Yeah, 16 years old is pretty with it. You were not a little kid. So why do you think the fade?
That we haven't had another one. We had the marathon bombing, so that was unquestionably terrorism on American soil. But you know, the TSA is starting to rewind some of their restrictions. And it's not in my face.
That is, I think, exactly the case. Even though, again, one could argue that wars and potential wars and the NSA, which is not in our face, even though it's in everything else of ours, is a manifestation of it 12 years after the fact. Chris, thank you for sharing your thoughts
We squeeze in one more?
No, actually, we can't squeeze
We can't squeeze in one more. Okay. Well, we won't squeeze in one more.
No, what are we doing tomorrow, Marjorie?
What are we doing tomorrow? It's Thursday. We have got
a Today is Wednesday and tomorrow is Thursday. That's right. It's rare that we agree on things. Let's say it again. Today is Wednesday. Tomorrow is Thursday.
Christopher Lydon is going to be with us, as he is every Thursday. We're excited about that. Tusk Professor Peniel Joseph is going to be here reopening the conversation about race in America. Jared Bowen will give us an update on how our mayoral candidates are thinking about arts and culture in Boston, which is going to be great because they've talked about every other thing. They have not talked about the arts, and Bill Walczak, you know, thinks that the casino in Boston or ever is going to decimate the arts in Boston. So stay tuned for that. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio. We want to thank you guys very much for listening to us today.
I want to say, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Jim Browdy. She is at Marjorie Egan. Yeah. And I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan. Thank you for listening
to
another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow.